In his years in the New South Wales Police Force, Gary Raymond was involved in a number of hostage negotiations. How are you today, Gary?
Yeah, really good, thanks, Vince.
Have you got a particular negotiation that comes to memory?
Yeah, look, when I was on general duties, we used to get called on occasions to situations and where someone was holding another person against their will. When I was in police rescue, we'd get called to assist our hostage negotiators and our tactical teams, or I suppose a common term is SWAT teams. And our role then was to assist, but on occasions I've dealt with people holding other people until the experts arrived, our special expert. And one particular one I remember was we got a call to a petrol station, a garage in Doonside, and it was a silent hold-up alarm that had been activated. And so when we arrived, we just stopped beside the garage and we get off to go on foot because driving straight into the driveway could cause you to drive in an extremely dangerous situation. So when I look around the corner, there's an offender armed with a knife, and he's got hold of the console operator, the garage worker, and there's two customers there on the floor face down. And so that's a very, very delicate situation. We don't want to startle the offender, because starting an offender often causes difficulties with their reaction and response to police presence. So I just yelled out, "It's the police are here, put your knife down." And what had happened, when he demanded money from the other side of the counter, the console operator had, with his knee, triggered the silent alarm, the hold-up alarm, and the offender had jumped the counter. This was before we had those anti-jump wires across the counter or any other protection, and then sort of held him a knife to his throat, asking him to open the till, which he did, and the offender scooped money. And as soon as we arrived, he then regained that posture, grabbing the garage worker and putting a knife to his throat, saying, "Stay away, let me go, or I'll kill him." Very delicate situation. You don't want to aggravate the offender. You don't want to cause the victim who's being held to do anything sudden or irrational, or I guess a physical response to cause, or even it can happen accidentally where suddenly there's movement between the two individuals and the knife could stab him, or the gun, if they had a gun, could go off, and all sorts of things. So I started negotiating with this fellow, saying, "Look, there's cops everywhere, you can't get out. So you're better off just..." And what you do with negotiation is give them some positive sort of consequences. Look, if you let him go now, you won't do as much jail. Look, if you don't harm him, the judge will see that, you know, you can't get away, you can't escape, so you will be arrested. But I'll tell you what, if you do it now, we'll be able to put in our facts for court that the offender, on demand from the police, released the hostage. And then after a while, it was only a short time, really, he decided that would be the best option. And so he just threw the knife down on my instruction, said, let the guy go. So he let him go, and at this stage we had our guns out pointing at him, and I said, "Move forward," and got him down on the ground. We handcuffed him and then searched him for further weapons. You always search an offender because the offender may have another weapon. The console operator was very shook up, and the two customers were pretty shook up emotionally, obviously having a critical incident stress response to what happened. We called an ambulance to just physically check them out first, and then just check their mental health out in case they needed to go to hospital for some further assessment. And so the detectives came to the garage, and the offender was taken away and interviewed, and then later charged with a number of pretty serious offences. And it comes in different varieties, I suppose, if I can call it that way. Often there's what we call false imprisonment, which is someone holding a person in a place against their will. It could be by threats, it could be by promises, it could be by some you know, false accusations, it could be all sorts of things where they're not allowing someone. We get that a lot in domestic situations, domestic violence, where husband, or it could be a wife, or a child. We've had children hold their parents in false imprisonment, not letting them out for various reasons. Usually it's to get money for drugs. Other domestic sort of situations, it's not so much a criminal one, but it's where it could be a husband or a wife, or again a child. And usually a husband will prevent his wife from leaving the residence by threatening them and saying no, you know, not giving them money, not giving them car keys. And it's not actually a criminal false imprisonment. Often it's the wife complies because of fear, and but it can be a false imprisonment, of course, and I have charged many with it. So you get this, what we commonly, loosely term as a hostage situation. I did another case where a criminal biker gang, one of their Harley Davidson motorbikes was stolen, and they got word off the streets that a particular young man either had or knew where the bike was. So they actually abducted him and took him to a house in Blacktown, and they held him there and bashed him up and tortured him until he would tell them where the bike was. And of course that's certainly the offence of false imprisonment, or holding him against his will, plus all the assaults and all the rest of those offences as well, the threats.
What's the difference between false imprisonment and kidnapping?
Well, kidnapping can happen before the false imprisonment or during. And so kidnapping is the taking of somebody, or abduction. And kidnapping is a term which they use for child abduction. And so abduction or kidnapping is much the same. There are slight differences, but certainly taking somebody against their will into another place and then holding them against their will could also be, you know, snatching someone off the street, or we've had it in domestics where a husband has forced the wife into the boot of a car and locked them in there, and either taken them somewhere or just left them locked in the boot. And certainly, again, there's a whole range of offences. And they're not uncommon, particularly, as I mentioned, in the domestic violence environment. The other hostage taking, which is, of course, as I mentioned, in that Tagaraj incident where an offender is suddenly trapped and they take hostages to be a bargaining tool. There's other ones that take hostages for other motives, which we'll talk about. But basically, it's the terrorism hostage situation is extremely dangerous. We've seen quite a number of them over the world and around the world. And so it's a method by which they can gain their own control. And I guess, too, it's very rare, but surviving being taken by a hostage is something that is not spoken about in the community too often at all. If being taken hostage never happened, again, why talk about it? But sadly, look, it can happen, although rare that is and unlikely, but it's very important, like a lot of situations in life that might be rare and unlikely, that if it does happen, we really know how to respond and how to act and how to survive being taken hostage.
So have you got some tips if one was taken hostage?
Firstly, look, as I mentioned, it's a rare event, but Vince, it's life-threatening consequences, and it's really sad we have to talk about this, but we hope people never use the information, never ever. However, if they do, the information is vital. I guess we look at hostage takers' motives. They're quite expressive or instrumental, and like an expressive motive means they gain a voice on an issue. There's, of course, religious fanaticism, and sometimes it's to publicise a grievance. There's been a number of those the people had taken television station hosts hostage and radio hosts hostage. They used to be very soft targets, but now the security in radio stations and television stations is quite tight. But they'd used to publicise a grievance, and then some just expressed their frustration with life and issues by doing an expressive motive. Taking people for ransom is another reason for its instrumental motive. Escape or safe passage, they'll take toss and say, you know, we're going to take this. And we've seen that a number of times with bank employees. Again, not so much now with the added security and banks. But they used to grab staff and take them away as hostage or even airline staff. And along with that, the instrumental motive might too be used them as a human shield and to try and shield them from possible police intervention. Of course, there's always the motive to either murder someone and suicide, take their own life as well. And I guess from police point of view, a lot of my negotiation was done with people threatening suicide by jumping off buildings and bridges and cliffs like the Gap, for example, or in the old days, the Sydney Harbour Bridge. There's less people threatening to jump off the bridge today because of the more scrutiny and security on the bridge with the bridge climb. Negotiation, for me, bought time for, I guess, the hostages and the perpetrators and us to get a chance to cool down. Because it's a very highly emotional, volatile situation. The startle reflex of the, you know, the perpetrators are high. Their fear factor is high. Their defence is high. Hostages are extremely stressed and frightened. We need to try and buy some time to cool everything down so that we're dealing more with a factual response than a feeling or emotional response, because emotions can do all sorts of things that we don't want to happen. The other reason why we negotiate is we try and clarify the hostage taker's motives. You know, why are they doing this? You know, why are they taking this action? Why are they putting themselves and someone else's life in jeopardy? What is it? What's going on? And so the time too, during the time that we're negotiating, it gives all our police a chance to gather intelligence on, firstly, the location, the hostage taker or takers, and the victims. So it gives us time to gather that intelligence. And also, negotiating, I think, Vince, gave us time to formulate a safe and effective hostage rescue strategy. And should the negotiation fail, then we have to take some action to release the hostages, and more about that shortly, but that's a very dangerous situation. But we've got to formulate a plan just in case we can't negotiate the offenders to disarm and to come out. And I think too that if you were taken hostage or held, you know, by an offender, you know, in a shopping centre or wherever they might have got pinned down by the police and they grab you, just remember, if you're a hostage, be very patient, because it mightn't appear to you, looking around, that police are doing anything. But let me assure you that we're very, very extremely busy planning or negotiating your safe release. And so it's not what you see, it's what happens behind the curtains, if you like. You're on the stage, but there's a whole raft of activity behind the curtains. And we're very busy working out how to rescue you and arrest the offender. And people should remember too, Vince, that the first few moments of a hostage situation are very dangerous for the victim. You know, the hostage taker will be extremely nervous about those initial actions, and it's a time bomb, really, if we're not careful. All hostages go into shock, and they'll go into a disbelief and denial that's happening. It's almost like a dream. They'll sort of think, is this really happening, or am I asleep and having a nightmare? I'm going to wake up and say, wow, I just dreamt that I was taken hostage. Physiological fight, flight, freeze and fracture hormones come screaming out through the endocrine system and cause all sorts of physical manifestations, including, you know, the frights and the getting ready for fight or flight and all those other things. that I mentioned. Look, and the other thing too is that you're faced with the prospect of living or dying at that time. And it brings their mortality in. They think about family and friends. The research shows they think about leaving their family and not being able to say goodbye. There's a whole range of things. And also the offender also, I guess, harbours a thought that the police might shoot them or in some other way, you know, stop them doing this. They may think they may get injured or by police. And they start thinking about their own mortality and become extremely protective. And one of the biggest things that people have to do if they're taken hostage is just comply with the demands of the hostage taker, if possible and if reasonable. Because keep in mind, Vince, that most of the deaths occur when a hostage threatens or antagonises the hostage taker. So the last thing we do is threaten them, for example, you know, stop doing this, otherwise, you know, or the police are going to shoot you, or you're going to jail for life, or if I get out of these rope constraints, look out. And that antagonises the hostage taker and sometimes even induces some action, either being assaulted by the hostage taker or even could be killed, or their confinement is made worse by, for example, putting a bag over your head and tying you up, or a gag on you. The more you stay without threatening or antagonising, the better. Look, and that included in that, I think, too, Vince, is don't harass the hostage taker over their behaviour or the actions towards you and other hostages. For example, if they happen to slap you across the face, one of the sayings is turn the other cheek, but don't chastise them over that or threaten them or insult them over their behaviour or just induce more of that behaviour to keep you quiet and to stop the insults. They'll assault you again and again if you're smart and cheeky. Try and stay calm and avoid open displays of cowardice or fear. Just stay neutral. Don't be aggressive towards them and don't show a lot of fear or cowardice, because what they'll interpret that is that you're not able to put up with it. In other words, they'll look at the hostages that can do this and eliminate those who can't. So that means, look, try if you can. And now, again, this is so difficult when your life's been threatened or your liberty, and is try not to cry or sob or beg or whinge. And try to stay fairly neutral emotionally. You might be tearing apart inside and absolutely distraught, but try if you can not to exhibit that openly, especially in front of the hostage takers. Often people have described to me that when the hostage taker turned around and looked out of the window or something, they started to shake and had a bit of a cry, but when they came back into the room or turned around, they stayed fairly stoic. And that'll help to survive. Look, a lot of people, especially men who might have some military or police background, or men who have been to the gym and they're strong and they're active, they start thinking through, planning to, to disarm the hostage taker. Under most circumstances, you shouldn't grapple for a hostage taker's weapon, an IED, that's an improvised explosive device, or other hazardous substance, unless you are certain of success. So if you're going to grapple with the hostage taker to disarm them, you've got to be really, really sure that you're going to be successful. Because if you're not successful and you can't disarm the offender, then look out. The retribution could be fatal, or, as I mentioned before, more restraints. A tighter situation that you're put in may even be put into your container and locked in there. All sorts of things can happen. You can be locked in a cupboard. Make sure that if you're going to wrestle, and of course the other thing that happens too is that during this wrestle, if you do get the weapon, unless the wrestle continues, then you or the offender might be severely injured or stabbed, and particularly you. And so if you're fighting for the weapon, accidents, inverted commas, can happen, and it can be rather nasty for everybody there, including the other hostages too. So in most circumstances, we don't grapple or wrestle for the weapon. Could be, and if you, you know, if you don't, it could be turned against you. Now, with escape attempts, again, one of the most dangerous times for a hostage is during or attempting to escape. Escape should only be a last resort, and only if the chances of success are really extremely high. It's like disarming. You've got to be sure that you're going to get out of there alive or uninjured before you make an attempt. It's got to be a last resort, because if you fail, it's going to become extremely consequential for you and the other hostages. Now, keep in mind too that if you're recaptured after an initial attempt to escape, you'll not likely get any other chance to escape, because they'll tighten up your confinement and they'll tighten up your imprisonment so that you don't or can't get another chance at escape. And so it's really, really difficult to make sure you can do it. Now, another thing too is that a lot of people say, and it's well documented, oh look, if I escape, I'm running away and abandoning the other hostages, leaving them. Look, you must stay alive, because you staying alive can assist the police with valuable intelligence to save the others. In other words, if you get a really good opportunity for a successful escape, don't stay there thinking, oh no, they might think I'm a coward, or they might think I'm abandoning them. No, get out. Because, number one, you stay alive, and secondly, the information that the police can get from you being in there is extremely valuable. That intelligence can help us to save the other hostages. And so it's important that if you're given the opportunity and safely do so and not be recaptured, get out. And I think too, look, a lot of people say, oh, you know, the hostage taker will kill you for sure, but when they're bargaining, or when they're trying to achieve their goal, remember that you're worth more alive than dead to the hostage taker. And so they'll only kill you if it's a last resort. And so if you can behave yourself, and if you can be compliant, again, to within reason, then while you're alive, you're a bargaining tool. They can use you to negotiate. They can use you to ransom whatever their motives happen to be. Another thing that happens too is sort of what we call a hostage-slave situation, where if a hostage taker holds a weapon to one other person, one other victim, to demand obedience from everybody else, everyone needs to strictly comply, because it may be a threat that won't be carried through, but then it may be. One of the ploys that you can use is to get the hostage taker to recognise you as a sort of a fellow human being. The captors, they see their hostages as objects to be used for a purpose. And so if you can humanise yourself with the captors, then that often does help, because they tend then to not look at you as a sort of an object, but a person who's in distress in that situation. And another thing is to display very good active listening skills. Don't feel that you've got to engage in a conversation with the hostage taker. Don't think that you've got to make conversation to make them feel good or change their minds. Be a very good listener. For example, if they scream out some political message or some other religious message, all you need to do is say, yes, I'm listening, I'm hearing what you're saying. Don't have to comment on it, because that can be dangerous. You don't have to say, I agree with you, because they know that you're really lying. But just really reassure them, I am listening. I'm listening to what you're saying. And because that's what they want as an audience, to listen to the particular reasons why they might be doing this. If the hostage taker asks questions, you don't have to comment on their statements, but, you know, they might ask a statement or a question. For example, in the case of a political or religious hostage taker, they might say, do you realise that so-and-so is the best God? And you don't have to reply to a statement, but they might ask it in question form. Do you agree that my God is the best God? And then you can answer that question, usually with a statement not being committed. In other words, well, can you tell me more about your God? Or, I don't know much about your God. Can you tell me some detail? Number one, that buys time. And number two, the hostage taker actually has someone there that's going to listen to them. And so by rhetorical questions or statements, then you're engaging them in conversation. If you say, no, I don't think your God's a better God, whoever that God might be, it might aggravate them, and really there could be consequences. So answer their questions very carefully, usually with rhetorical questions or statements, and don't engage in too much lengthy conversation with them. One of the biggest things you've got to be very careful of, Hence, is avoid making suggestions to your hostage taker. Look, they'll be very suspicious as to your motives for that, and they probably interpret your good suggestions maybe as a positive or a negative. You know, a good suggestion might be, you know, could we allow this mother to feed the baby? That's all right. Or you might say, oh, instead of sitting at that table, could you move across to that table, knowing that it's closer to the window where police snipers may get a better shot? And so if you suggest that to the hostage, they're going to say to you straight away, you're trying to get me killed, and there could be consequences very negatively for you. So they'll be looking to maybe interpret your good suggestions either positive or negative way. Look, very respectful. I know it's hard, but give short answers and be very, very respectful. Foster communication on non-threatening topics. So if there's a conversation takes place, for example, where were you born? I was born so-and-so. Tell us a bit about your mum and dad. You know, that's non-threatening topics. What do you like eating? What's your favourite food? Where do you like holidaying? These sort of topics that won't normally have a response from the hostage taker, but if you talk about politics or religion or ideology or philosophy or any of those things, they might see it as threatening or aggravating, so try not to aggravate them. Yeah, look, be stoic and maintain outward face of acceptance of adversity with dignity. And we've found in the research that that'll win your hostage taker's respect. In other words, you're not going to come against them, and yet you're giving some sort of indication you're accepting their plight, although we don't tell them we accept their plight, but you can through your, remain with dignity. And just carefully observe, and this is a good suggestion, what makes your hostage taker happy and behave that way. In other words, if you're not looking at them, for example, you're not eyeballing them, which is not good anyway, and they might say, good, you look that way, I'm happy you look that way. And so you then comply, okay, so he or she is happy with me not eyeballing them or staring them out, good. I'll keep them happy by not doing that. So just observe that. Now, if they order you not to communicate with other hostages, like in the garage situation, the fellow behind the counter who's holding hostage with a knife, said to the two customers on the floor, look, he's got me here, you can leave. And so he told him, that he said, shut up. He said, don't talk. So look, if you're ordered not to communicate with other hostages, don't communicate. Look, and if you do, use extreme caution. I mean extreme caution, making sure that you don't get caught. Often signaling may be better than talking. You can use signals with your hands or your eyes or your mouth without getting caught communicating with the other hostages. And it's amazing how you can develop non-verbal signaling in that situation if you're required. So. Now, from a Christian point of view, often Christians who are held hostage or falsely imprisoned in a situation where they're being held for ransom or whatever, they often pray silently and sometimes pray openly. It's interesting too, the research shows, which I believe, that most hostage takers don't prohibit prayer, because the ones who have got religious ideation and other, you know, they know that prayer is part of being in a tight situation. And so you can pray silently and or openly, just quietly and non-aggressive prayer. And most hostage takers will then know that you're a person of faith, whatever that faith might be. And often that helps, because some of the religious hostage takers, people of faith, inverted commas, even though it's a very distorted faith, because they're doing things like this, but still, you know, yeah. And well, I guess a lot of people, Vince, have heard of the Stockholm Syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Some people haven't, but it's very important. It's the relationship between the captors and the hostages develops over time. What happens after a while is that the hostages can become dependent on the captors. They perceive their captors as protectors. Oh, they're protecting us now against the police. I better be on their side, because these awful police are out there trying to do something to these captors, and I might get caught up in the middle of it. The hostages begin to empathise with their captors' cause. And they might, particularly after conversation, and as the captors talk to the hostages about what their motives are, why they're there, and what their gripes are, and what their cause is, and sometimes hostages can actually be taken in. And so a lot of it's fear-based and survival-based, but they can actually empathise with their cause. They can actually then start to perceive law enforcement as a danger to their safety. In other words, you know, the cops are going to come in here and shoot everyone. And so, you know, if I keep them good with these captors, they'll keep me safe. And the other dangerous thing about the Stockholm Syndrome is they become so dependent on their captors, they actually will tell the captors of the police movements if they see them. That's why we've got to be very careful the way we move around a scene, just in case the rescuers are compromised by the hostages telling their captors where the police are hiding, or what they saw them do, where they saw them moving. Look, this Stockholm Syndrome can achieve release, with everyone empathising together, including the captor, and then they all decide, well, you know, let's not do this, let's get out. Or it could have caused a very catastrophic end, where the hostages and the captors start coming against the police with weapons, and that's been seen in the past. So the hostages might even commit crime, escape and join their captors. We've seen a few situations like that.
That happened in the United States with a lady called Patty Hearst, didn't it?
Correct, yes. She was a prime example of the Stockholm Syndrome, where she began to relate to her captors and empathise with them and, in fact, joined them.
Mm.
And, yeah, so it's often to do with psychological dependence or codependence, where fear turns into empathy, and empathy turns into agreeing with them. It is a survival mode, although can get out of survival mode, and actually they really and sincerely believe in the captor's cause and want to fight with them and for them. And that was a prime one, that one, and there's been quite a few others too. Now, another huge danger is the hostages should be very careful talking to other captives, especially about escaping or other sort of, I suppose you could say, classified information that you might have, where the police are, for example, or what the hostage taker is doing. See, because one of the dangers is you don't know whether a fellow captive may rat on you to get favour of the kidnapper, or one of the captives may in fact be a captor themselves and a spy. It doesn't happen so much in, crime situations or domestic situations, although that can happen, but it's mostly in the religious or other philosophical captors where someone, they might even, part of their plans is to plant one of their own as a hostage to get intelligence and information as to what the other captives are doing or saying. Or it can be a genuine hostage who decides in survival that if they get favour with the kidnapper, then they won't kill them or they will release them. And so they'll rat or tell on you about the things that you do and say. So just be, even if you know the people that you're captive with, be very careful that they may turn against you given their survival instincts. So don't trust anyone in that situation unless you're really confident, really, really confident. So the negotiations continue, and hopefully we all pray that the offenders put their weapons down and come out and without harm to the hostages, or let the hostages go first and then give up themselves. Nobody, including the police, and especially the police, wants to see anyone hurt, anyone killed. We want a peaceful outcome to these situations, and the offenders too. It's far better for them if they allow the hostages to go and give up when it comes to their, obviously, their sentencing in court. All of that will be taken into consideration. So I guess the question arises, if the negotiation fails and the police decide to do entry, which is one of the most extremely dangerous things to do for everybody included, so what do we do there? Well, if you hear or see the police raid in progress to rescue you, or if you're by yourself or the other hostages, if possible, drop straight down to the ground, face down. Immediately. Just go straight down, face down, no matter what you're doing at the time. And if possible, when you go down, have your head away from the offender. Because if the offender starts to shoot, or stab, or whatever, then you want to protect your head in particular. And this sounds a bit awful, but if you're going to get shot in the leg or the backside, that's a bit better than the head. So you try and have your head away from the offender in case they start shooting, if they've got a firearm. Spread eagle your arms and close your legs. And this is very important. This is absolutely important. Display your open hands, either upwards or downwards. Have your hands open because the police entering the premises will be looking for people with weapons in their hands. And if you display open hands, immediately that's a very quick signal to the entering police that you haven't got a weapon in your hands. Just stay very still and silent. Don't attract the captor's attention. And don't move. Just stay there until directed by your rescuing police. Now, again, unless you must like get out of there straight away with a hazardous situation such as a fire, or something else like that, where you don't have to wait for people to tell you to get out. You just make your escape if you have to. But just stay there because the police will look after you. If you hear or see the police raid in progress again and you've done those things, you need to prepare yourself for shouting, police will be shouting who they are and what their intention is, and shouting to the offender or offenders. There might be gunfire. There could be loud noises, bright flashing lights, sudden darkness, shock waves, instant, sort of irritant gas in the air. And you might even be physically handled by the police until we find out who the hostage takers are and who the hostages are. Police might search you and handcuff or table tie you, with those plastic ties until the captors have been identified, arrested, or regrettably neutralised. And so all of these things may happen to you, and it's not the police being aggravating you or being nasty or scaring you. It's things that we have to do on entry. For example, we use several types of apparatus which make a loud bang and a light which distracts the hostage taker, the gas which might irritate them, and things like that. So there's sudden darkness because we might turn the lights out from the electricity box and all sorts of things. It's a very scary environment. However, just stay calm on the ground or on the floor, wherever you happen to be, and you'll be right. We might urgently evacuate you, but be sure that as soon as we get you out of there and liberate you, you'll be taken to immediate medical and psychological support immediately while we sort out what's been going on. The police might want you to stay there after you've been assessed by doctors, nurses or paramedics, because we may need to get a statement from you. And the earlier we can get the statement, the more fresh in your memory the incident is. You'll get referred then to some psychological help, some chaplaincy help, and a lot of other support services while you deal with the aftermath of this.
What would you do if you had a chance to run from a hostage situation?
Yeah, as I mentioned, if it's safe to do so and you're sure that you'll get away, you can run. But if there's any doubt, if you're recaptured, or you might even be shot or stabbed on the way out, then you'll lose your life and be injured. So if you do run or escape, you have to be extremely sure that you can get away. For example, you might run towards a door and it's locked. Or you might go towards a window and it's too small to get out. So you've got to plan it well and make sure you get out, because any attempt that you fail, it's going to be extremely bad consequences for you and the other hostages. The offender will be extremely cautious from that moment on. But sometimes they'll let you go. It's not unusual at times for hostage takers to show some goodwill, inverted commas, by letting people go and showing the other hostages, well, if you behave yourself, there are some benefits to this. I've got a heart and I can let, pregnant women go, or I can let sick men go, or children. But make sure that, again, that permission to leave is not, imagined, but it's a real instruction that you can leave safely. Yeah.
And what if you got outside the building and you're running towards police? What should you do?
Yeah, just run towards police. Leave your hands fessed up with open hands. Just show you, because there has been some cases overseas where one of the hostage takers has run out pretending to be a hostage with a means of, getting out of the situation, escaping. So what we do as police officers, we treat everyone as a hostage taker and part of the plot, if you like, until we know otherwise. Now, it's not being unkind. It's just being extremely cautious. I often think after these situations, as a Christian cop, I would come home and I'd be uptight for quite a while and have a cup of tea and a little bit of a talk to Michelle. And then I'd usually come into my study, close the doors just to be alone for a while and talk to God about it. And it came to mind that the Bible says that we're all sinners and we're captivated by sin, and we're captivated by our the Adamic nature, the nature we got from our first parents disobeying God. We're infused with that. We're similar. In other words, we're captive to sin. The devil Satan always takes us hostage because he wants to use us and destroy us because of his shocking rebellion against God. But guess what? I found out on the 29th of November 1979, when I was captive to my own life, my own sin, and I just needed release. There was a terrible thing happened, and I was walking around home feeling chained up, captive, and I wanted to cry, but I couldn't because I wasn't allowed to cry, being a tough police rescue operator. Glanced back, and my whole life was a mess, self-gratification, drinking, partying, and trying to do things that made me feel good, and it just it tangled me up. You become entangled in sin. At first, you step into, you know, the sin environment, but then it tangles you and you can't escape. And then I remember falling on the floor, my knees and elbows screaming, "Jesus, I need you now." And with those wonderful words, even within an instant, as I cried and cried and cried on that floor, I felt a freedom, I felt a release. I felt suddenly that I was out of this cage of my own life and my own behaviour. You know, no more blaming the job, no more blaming others. I realised then that what God had done was on the cross, he had this moment in mind, and when he died to take the penalty for my sin and also to shield me from the wrath of God for what I'd done, then he actually, the wrath of God came on him for what we deserve. And as that came to mind, my old Sunday school days returned, and I realised that, yes, I'd been rescued, and God had now rescued me, and I was so grateful, and even this very day, this very moment, I'm so grateful for rescue by God through Jesus on the cross. And the other amazing thing is, too, that Jesus actually rose from the dead to show that he was actually God the Son. He was God. And so with that, from a police officer's point of view, the evidence was clear. God was real. Jesus, what he did was real. I now was a free man, absolutely free to love Jesus, to serve him, to communicate with him and him with me. And I'll never, ever, ever give up that freedom again.
That's wonderful, Gary. I've been talking with retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond. Thanks for speaking with us today, Gary. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thanks very much, Vince, and listeners.